This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we explore Colorado's deeply felt connection to beer.
Beer has been a part of our life since 1859. And if you look closely at it, and if you shine a light through the pint of beer at just the right angle, it shows you what life was like for people at different times in our state's history.
We also explore the connection between Colorado's K-12 student population and state funding.
That's coming up.
It's Tuesday, October 8th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Warm temperatures, low humidity, and wind mean elevated fire danger today, especially in the high country. This comes as the Decker Fire south of Salida and the Middle Mam Fire near the city of Rifle continue to burn. Over the past few weeks on the show, we've been bringing you reporting on how fires like these are managed, from new technology to old techniques. But researchers are saying it just might be time to rethink wildfire management practices. Here to tell us more is KUNC's Ray Ellen Bashel. Hi, Ray.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first, can you just tell us about how wildfires are currently managed?
I think the simplest summary is that they get put out when they're threatening people and their homes. The thing to remember is that people and their homes, that's a group that is expanding a lot as our communities grow. And so while land managers in a place like Alaska, where there might not be a lot of homes, they can let massive fires burn and they're not threatening people. We can't do that here in a place like Colorado. Mm-hmm. It may not seem like it, given how much you hear about wildfire on the news, but they actually get put out really quickly. I saw a statistic about how, at least for wildfire on federal lands, about 95% of them are contained pretty quickly. And some researchers are saying that that's a problem.
You reported on a perspective piece that was co-written by Colorado State University's Courtney Schultz. What did she argue?
Yeah, her article was in Science, which is a really well-regarded journal. And Schultz studies wildfire policy. And she said basically what a lot of other people have also said, which is that we have to learn to live with fire.
So that might mean supporting more ignitions to burn when they naturally ignite rather than putting them out when we can do that. And then it also is definitely going to mean getting more prescribed fire on the ground. So intentionally igniting fires so that fire can play its role, but we can do it at times when maybe it's not going to be as extreme or maybe when the smoke impacts aren't going to be as intense on communities.
That theme of letting more burn or of good fire, positive fire, it's come up a lot in recent conversations, including with a researcher in Idaho who was telling me that really hot and extreme fires can lead to pretty bad erosion and flooding. And when that happens, it can actually send all this dirt and lumber into our reservoirs, which leaves less space for drinking water. That researcher's name is Brendan Murphy. He's a watershed scientist at Utah State University. And he said that you can drag all the muck back out, but
if you wait until this happens, it can cost tens of millions of dollars to dredge that sediment out. So the alternative is that managing our water resources in the West may really come down to managing our fires in the West.
So in the long run, letting small and less extreme fires, just letting them burn, could help save a reservoir.
So when it is determined that it is appropriate to fight a fire rather than let it burn, fire managers have some new tools that they can work with, right?
Yeah, my colleague with the Mountain West News Bureau, who's based in Nevada, he did a story on how people are using drones to study fire behavior. Then I have another colleague with the Mountain West News Bureau in Colorado Springs, and she reported on how Colorado, our state, is training helicopter pilots to fight fire at nighttime. And then I was really interested to see a research paper come out recently that described this new invention, which is a gel-like substance that these researchers are saying will help make fire retardant stick to plants better. And that's the fire retardant is that red stuff that you see airplanes drop onto forests.
Oh, yeah. That's always a spectacular image.
Yeah, it's good pictures. So the idea is, you know, that spray, that red fire retardant, it can get washed away or blown away really easily by, you know, wind and rain. And the idea here is that by adding this gel, it could help keep that fire retardant in wildfire-prone areas for a whole season. So maybe it would prevent a lot more fires.
Yeah, a little preemptive action.
I did reach out to people in the wildfire world who had some hesitations. They said this seems really promising, but they did have questions about things like cost, which is a big deal, and also whether it would make sense on the vegetation that we have here in Colorado, especially given that it's like designed to stick around for a while.
Well, we are, you know, seeing the wildfire season grow longer due to climate change. And I'm wondering, does this change how researchers are thinking about mitigation?
I think it's probably been changing how researchers think about mitigation for a while. I feel like in my experience, the refrain, this constant theme, is that we have to learn how to deal with them and live better with them, because overall they are going to get more frequent and more extreme as predictions go. And that's driving a lot of the work that's going on right now.
Thanks for following this.
Yeah, thanks.
Ray Ellen Bichelle is a reporter with KUNC and the Mountain West News Bureau. You can find more reporting at our website, KUNC.org.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
The front runners in Colorado's U.S. Senate race both say they raised more than $2 million during the latest fundraising period. Former Governor John Hickenlooper says he raised $2.1 million in the first 5 weeks of his campaign. But Republican Senator Cory Gardner, the incumbent, still has a fundraising edge. He says he brought in more than $2.4 million in the past 3 months, and his campaign says he still has more than $6 million left to spend. The other candidates haven't released their fundraising totals yet. They have until next week to do that.
The Longmont City Council will consider declaring a climate emergency at its meeting tonight. The resolution calls on the council to convene a climate working group. It would look at ways to promote a carbon-free, sustainable city. Longmont has already set citywide goals of 100% renewable energy by 2030, but activists say that isn't enough. Boulder and Fort Collins city councils have passed similar emergency resolutions in the past year. Every fall, college freshmen across the country participate in a traditional event, Rush Week. But what if a student wants to join a Greek letter organization, but becoming a brother or sister doesn't fit? As KUNC's Stephanie Daniel reports, a group at the University of Colorado Boulder is making Greek life more inclusive.
It's the second night of Rush Week for Theta Pi Sigma. More than a dozen students have split into two groups to play a Google version of Family Feud. Senior Naya O'Reilly huddles with one of the teams.
Yeah, do we want a name? Team name? Anyone?
O'Reilly identifies as a non-binary femme, using the pronouns they, them, theirs. And after arriving at CU, says they didn't fit in on the majority white campus and have endured discrimination and microaggressions.
Because I'm also mixed racial. I'm Black, Filipino, and Mexican.
O'Reilly even considered leaving the university.
I was like, I don't like CU. I don't feel like I belong here. And Theta Pi, thank God, became my home and cemented my place here.
Theta Pi Sigma is open to any gender and sexual identity. The 20-year-old was part of the first pledge class in the spring of 2018 and has been president ever since. They specifically chose the organization to make friends and...
They wouldn't have called me a brother or a sister. I didn't have to fall within a binary for them. I could be genuinely who I am, no matter what that was, with them.
Theta Pi Sigma is not a fraternity or sorority, and members are called siblings. It was originally founded at the University of California, Santa Cruz in 2005, and according to their website, is the first all-gendered Greek organization. There are about six chapters at colleges across the U.S.
Traditionally, fraternities and sororities were created around traditional notions of both gender and sexuality.
Kathleen Gillen is an assistant professor of higher education at the University of Maine and researches Greek life. Phi Beta Kappa was the first and began in 1776. By the turn of the 20th century, she says fraternities and sororities were a college staple, but only for those permitted to attend.
So typically this was white students, cisgender students, Protestant students, upper-class students.
As higher education opened its doors to more and more students of color, Greek life began to reflect this diversity. The first Black and Asian American fraternities were founded in the early 1900s.
Really in response, again, to issues of exclusion within their curricular and co-curricular experiences, but also serving as opportunities for these men to come together and feel validated in regard to who they were, in regard to their race and their culture.
Over the past century, Greek life has blossomed to include all genders and groups. Gillen says this has allowed queer, transgender, or gender non-binary students to create organizations which allow them to identify and socialize in ways that are authentic and represent who they are. Back at the Theta Pi Sigma Rush event at CU.
So, cucumbers are...
The family feud game is ramping up.
Eli got that one.
Okay. Freshman Eli Harvey identifies as a pansexual, African-American, non-binary, transgender man. And he's a potential recruit. Before learning about Theta Pi Sigma, Harvey considered joining a frat, but says it's intimidating.
It's hard to try to find people, or specifically fraternities, that will be like, yeah, come and join or whatever.
So far, Harvey is enjoying the process and plans to attend all the Theta Pi Sigma events. He's met new people and feels comfortable talking about gender, sexuality, and race.
They really try their hardest to invite all of us into a space where we feel welcome and safe, and I couldn't ask for anything better.
Harvey is part of another all-gendered community on campus. He lives in Spectrum, a residence hall for LGBTQ students. Freshman Shar Donaldson also lives there. Donaldson, who is white and transitioning to female, says it's made living on campus really, really easy.
I met so many people who are accepting and are really similar to me.
Donaldson is also having fun at game night, but is on the fence about pledging Theta Pi Sigma.
But I'd have to know more about it because I know it's a really fun group, but I don't know about the responsibility. And like, I've just spent time doing school and stuff like that.
Do fish ever...
Naya.
Pew.
The chapter currently has 20 active members, and President Naya O'Reilly believes it is shaking up Greek life traditions, and not only at CU.
I hope and do believe that Greek life is going to start slowly molding itself to look more similar to Theta Pi Sigma, because everyone should be given a chance to be a Greek.
Survey says...
Stephanie Daniel, KUNC Boulder.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC. Last week, school districts across the state performed an annual count of the students in their schools. Count Day, as it's known, is important because it determines the official enrollment numbers, which is then used by the state to determine funding. Joining us now to go more in-depth with the numbers and what they mean is Erica Meltzer, Bureau Chief of Chalkbeat, Colorado. Hey, Erica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with funding. Can you briefly explain how a district's count determines the funding it receives?
Well, Colorado uses mostly per pupil funding, and the exact amount is different based on different district characteristics. But then once you've determined the amount of money per student that a district gets, they need to count the total number of students, and they also need to know, for example, how many of those students qualify for free lunch under the federal school lunch program, and how many students are English language learners. Districts get a little bit more money for those students. But basically, this is the number that determines how much money the district is going to have to work with for the year.
And so how do these official count numbers, you know, from any given district fluctuate from year to year? Is it common to see big changes in either direction?
In districts that are seeing a lot of growth, or in the case of gentrification, maybe a district is getting more expensive and families are moving away, sometimes the year-over-year change can be kind of dramatic. For example, looking at last year's numbers, District 49 in El Paso County added almost 1,000 students. And then conversely, last year, Jefferson County lost almost 1,500 students. So that these numbers represent millions of dollars.
That's a lot at stake then for school districts if they have a big change.
It is. And there is one thing that districts can do. It's usually done by districts that are losing population, is that they do have an option to do a five-year average, and that sort of lessens the impact year over year. So they have a little, eventually those lower numbers are going to catch up with them, but they do have some time to at least adjust to it.
It sounds like it's really important to ensure kids are actually there in school for count day. You know, what happens if there's a flu outbreak or...
There are some ways to work around it. There was a number of years ago that count day actually fell on Rosh Hashanah, and it became a bit of a situation because districts were sending home these very sternly worded letters saying, your student better be in school on count day or else. And of course, you know, Jewish parents did not appreciate that. We now actually have some guidance that if count day falls on a major religious holiday, they will move the count day to account for that. In some ways, count day is a little bit of a misnomer. There is an actual 11-day count period that's 5 days before and 5 days after. And the school districts can demonstrate that a student who was absent on count day for some reason, that they really are enrolled. But it requires more paperwork because what the state doesn't want is that a student has actually transferred out maybe the day before count day and the district is trying to get the credit for them. And so there's more work that the district has to do to demonstrate the student really is enrolled here.
And so what did we learn from this year's count day? What's the picture like across the state?
Well, we won't know the final numbers until January, but I think what we'll likely see is a number of continuing trends about where students are leaving and where students are moving to. For example, down in Colorado Springs, the Gazette had a story that District 11, which has been losing students for a number of years now, is almost certainly no longer the largest district in the county, that it was overtaken by Academy 20, another district that's very fast growing in there. I already mentioned District 59. And so this represents children no longer living in the center of the city and living more in the surrounding areas. And looking more at the metro area, we're expecting flat or declining enrollment in Denver. There's some hope that Jeffco and Aurora might be stabilizing, but they have been losing students, whereas Weld County, Adams County, El Paso County, we're all seeing more families move in there. We're expecting student population to go up.
And I know you recently spoke with Colorado's state demographer, Elizabeth Garner. What did you learn when you talked with her?
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting, I knew that there had been a big decline in births associated with the Great Recession. People talk about a baby bust. People did not feel like they could afford to have children. They put their plans on hold. What I thought was interesting talking to her is that we really haven't recovered from that. And this is a national phenomenon that between the cost of housing, the cost of childcare, the student loan debt that young people are carrying, a lot of people just feel like they can't afford to bring a child into the world. And so one thing she was clear about is that these things are not static. They could change again if there's policy changes that make people feel more optimistic. But we're not looking at a big resurgence in births anytime soon. And these have long-term implications for school districts because on the one hand, if you don't have a student there, so theoretically there shouldn't be a cost to educate them. But school districts have buildings and they have staff and they have a lot of fixed costs. And if you lose a classroom's worth of kids, you don't necessarily lose a classroom's worth of expenses. And so this is going to be a challenge that school districts are going to be wrangling with over the next decade.
Erica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Erica Meltzer is the Bureau Chief for Chalkbeat, Colorado.
It's no secret that beer is popular in Colorado, a state that has hundreds of established breweries. And over the weekend, people from all over the state and all over the world celebrated their love and appreciation for the fermented beverage at the Great American Beer Festival in Denver. But amidst the celebration was competition.
At the end of it all, Colorado brewers walked away with 40 total medals, 13 of which were gold, in styles ranging from American-style IPAs to gluten-free beer. Not a bad showing from our beer-loving state.
That's right. And if you didn't make it out to the festival or are just curious to know more about how the history of beer and our state are intertwined, there's an exhibit at History Colorado in Denver that can take you down that path. Our producer Lily Tyson visited the exhibit called Beer Here, Brewing the New West, and took a tour with Sam Bach, a public historian with History Colorado.
You know, we were really, over a couple of beers, of course, wondering why the state has 360 breweries. And, you know, if you think about it, we don't grow a lot of hops or barley, and we don't have much water. So why would we have this huge brewing industry here? So when we started looking at it, we realized it's a historical question. And you have to go all the way back to 1859, to when the first beer was brewed here in Denver, to find out. So, of course, Colorado was born in the gold rush, and beer came west just about as fast as the miners. So the very first beer was made in Denver in 1859, right at the confluence of Cherry Creek and the Platte River. And, you know, of course, at that time, beer wasn't really served at home. It was served in saloons. And in a lot of these mining towns in Colorado, the saloon was the first and sometimes the only real building in town. And so it served some of the most important social functions and sort of town functions that you would expect from a local government or local businesses. But before that, you know, you only had a saloon. And beer was a really big part of that. And so, you know, it was part of this wave of German immigration that brought beer to Colorado in the 1860s. So as we continue moving through the exhibit, you know, we come to the time in Colorado's history that I personally think is the most interesting. It's Prohibition. And so Colorado goes dry in 1916, which is 4 years earlier than the rest of the country. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of them is that the burdens, the negative effects of alcohol consumption were unequally falling on women in Colorado in the early 20th century. You know, it's this moment when these women are exercising their political rights to protect themselves from domestic violence, from the financial hardships that often come along with alcoholism. And what we wanted to do with this exhibit was humanize these people, humanize the prohibitionists and the temperance advocates, because I think a lot of the time the attitude towards them is, oh, weren't they silly? You know, weren't they killjoys? But for them, this was a real public health crisis. And they spoke about alcohol addiction in a lot of the same way as we speak about the opioid crisis today. And that's a really interesting parallel. And that got me really interested in thinking about what else can we learn about the time by looking at beer, by looking at Prohibition and why Prohibition came about.
Taste the high country.
So, of course, Coors is one of these large beer manufacturers around the sort of middle of the 20th century in the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, who realized that Americans wanted beer that didn't have a lot of flavor, that was what we would call sessionable today. It was easy to drink, and it had low alcohol. And it was great for them because it meant they could sell more beer, and it was great for consumers because it meant they could drink it and not be really, really drunk at the end of the day just from having a couple of beers. As we get further along in the 1970s, though, there's a group of folks who have traveled abroad or who have experienced different styles of beer in various places around the country and who realize that there's more to beer than just this light American lager that we're familiar with. And at the time, there really wasn't an easy way to get it. And so they had to figure out how to make it for themselves. And in Colorado, you can't talk about homebrewing without talking about Charlie Papazian. He was one of these folks, we call them New Westerners, who in the early 1970s figured out that they could choose where they wanted to live. And so Charlie, being a guy who really likes to hang out outside, go hiking and biking and all these different kinds of things, he comes to Colorado. And he looks around and he tries to figure out what he's going to do. So he starts teaching homebrewing classes at the community free school up in Boulder. These classes become super popular. And so Charlie thinks to himself, hey, you know, we should make an organization for this. So he founds the American Homebrewing Association in Boulder and starts publishing a magazine called Zymergy. And that eventually grew into what we know as the Great American Beer Festival today, which of course turns Colorado into the hub of the craft beer universe for a long weekend every fall. And that is so important to understanding how we got to this point where we have 360 breweries. That, of course, is the central question of this exhibit. How did we get to that point? And I think you really have to start the answer to that question in 1859. It tracks through Coors and it tracks through Charlie Papazian all the way up until this point where you start getting craft beer breweries opening here in Colorado. And of course, from there, you know, we get this proliferation of different craft beers. And of course, the rise of brew pubs. I think we may have had a governor recently who had something to do with a brew pub.
Well, I was a geologist. I got laid off, couldn't find a job. So like anybody, I saw this brew pub thing coming and opened a brew pub.
Now, of course, John Hickenlooper is the founder of Wine Coop Brewing Company. And that's the state's very first brew pub. And it's hard to overstate the importance of places like that because they not only were community gathering spots, but they played this really big role in transforming downtown Denver into, you know, what we think of it as today, which is a place where people want to live and hang out. And so you see this massive cultural change going on, and you can see it going on through the lens of beer. And then we wrap up with a display of a pint glass from every brewery in the state, and we call it Pint's Peak. And I think the coolest thing about Pint's Peak is that when you get up really close to these brewery's glasses. You can see it's an entrepreneur's dream. It's a community that comes together over a couple of beers. It's a business. It's a culture. But when you stand back and you see all 360 of them together, they show how big this thing has gotten, how big this brewing industry here is in this state. And it's because of that beauty and purity and the outdoor lifestyle that people moved here for that we have this. It's part of our culture. It's not a personality quirk. It's really something that matters to people in Colorado. And I think that's the takeaway message here. It's that beer has been a part of our life since 1859. And if you look closely at it, and if you shine a light through the pint of beer at just the right angle, it shows you what life was like for people at different times in our state's history. And I think that's really cool, and it's really powerful.
You can visit the exhibit until it closes in August 2020.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll get you up to speed on the contentious Northern Integrated Supply Project that would construct two new reservoirs in our area. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer. And before we leave you today, we want to take a quick moment to thank KUNC's news director, Catherine Welch. The show wouldn't be what it is today without her insight, ideas, guidance, and organization.
That's absolutely right. She championed this show as a way to bring even more local news content to our listeners. Today is her last day at KUNC as she heads to Florida to take on new adventures with her family. So, Kat, thank you for everything and all the best to you.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.